Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This month marks the 50th anniversary of a milestone in the history of the civil rights movement, the Mississippi Summer Project, also known as Freedom Summer. That story is told in a new PBS American Experience documentary called Freedom Summer, which airs on June 24th. In this archival footage from the film, civil rights activist and project organizer Bob Moses explains the project.
We hope to send into Mississippi this summer upwards of 1,000 students from all around the country who will engage in Freedom Schools, voter registration activities, and open up Mississippi to the country.
Before those students headed down to Mississippi, many went through training in Oxford, Ohio. Joining us now by phone from New York is one of those volunteers, Mark Levy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Also with us in the studio is Ohio State University historian Hassan Jeffries. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Before we hear about Mark's personal experience with the project, Hassan Jeffries, can you set the scene for us in the lead up to that summer in 1964?
Absolutely. As Bob Moses, the project director for SNCC, just mentioned, one of the goals of the summer project was to, quote, open up Mississippi. Civil rights activists and others referred to Mississippi, the state of Mississippi, as a closed society. It was seemingly not America on one hand, and on another hand, very much America, meaning that African Americans were discriminated against in every conceivable way, excluded almost absolutely from the voter registration rolls. Racial terrorism and violence was at a high. Mississippi, 10 years earlier, was the place where Emmett Till had been murdered. One year earlier, Medgar Evers had been murdered, civil rights NAACP field secretary. So Mississippi was a violent place. It was a dangerous place. It was a place that where white supremacy ruled. Ross Barnett, the governor of Mississippi, for example, was an ardent white supremacist. And SNCC activists decided to move on Mississippi, a place where other civil rights activists, including the NAACP, including SCLC, Martin Luther King's organization, opted not to go at the national level. They said it's just too dangerous and they wouldn't be able to really make any headway there. And so SNCC decided if we can turn Mississippi, we can turn America. And this Freedom Summer Project was an extension of the efforts that they had begun there at the beginning of the decade in 1960.
Mark Levy, I was 7 years old that year. I didn't know anything about what was going on. You attended the two-week training in Oxford, Ohio before heading down to Mississippi. What did you know about what was going on in Mississippi that inspired you to volunteer?
Well, I think Professor Jeffries' setup and description of what was going on in Mississippi was absolutely accurate. We knew that. SNCC told us over and over again, one of the ways that those of us who at that time were not activists developed a trust for SNCC was that they were very honest and upfront. I was a student government activist at Queens College at the right time, at that time, and this just seemed the right thing to do, and it was the times. The reasons why I agreed to go to Mississippi with my wife when a woman named Dottie Zellner, who worked for SNCC and went to Queens College, when she asked me, I said yes for a number of reasons. Probably the first was that I'm Jewish, and growing up Jewish meant to me that I was aware or hyper-aware of discrimination, of the Holocaust, and the commitment on my family's part, and I guess on my religion's part, to social justice and a sense to make the world a better place. It was also the times. It was the end of the fear-filled McCarthy period. John Kennedy had been elected, and youth were invited to get involved. The 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom had shown that masses of people, and not just brave activists, could get together. And the winds of change existed around the world that made it seem more like the the thing to do. I guess the last point I would make relates to what Professor Jeffries was saying. We didn't go as missionaries. We were asked to come down to help. That made a huge difference to me. There was an organization, there were rank and file organizations and leaders, and we were going down to help them with what they wanted us to do for them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the Mississippi Summer Project, also known as Freedom Summer. There is a free advance screening of the American Experience documentary, Freedom Summer. It's tonight at the Gateway Film Center. For more information, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Freedom Summer will air on WOSU-TV on June 24th. Mark Levy, what did you learn from the training in Oxford?
What did I learn from the training? I learned that Mississippi was a closed society in a very brutal state. I learned that the activists, the SNCC leaders, and the core leaders who had pulled together orientation and the project were respectful people. And I learned a lot about teaching and about voter rights, some of the very specifics that we were going to have to deal with. It was a wonderful opening to the summer.
And Hassan Jeffries, tell us about the people, mostly young people, that went and volunteered to took up the invitation to go down to Mississippi and do this. Were most of them like the way Mark Levy describes himself? Is there any way you can generalize or not?
I think Mark represents or is representative of the kinds of students who did wind up volunteering. Many came from the Northeast, some from Stanford out west. A number of them were activists in their own way, committed to social justice, brought to it either through family, through social experience, through religion. A number of the standouts were Jewish, in fact. And it's important to point out that the majority of the volunteers were white, young white college students. And that wasn't an accident. There were two principal reasons for that. The appeal was open to both African American students and white students, but the African American students had a difficult time being able to pay their own way. I mean, so economics. I mean, the other component of it is that these weren't most of the volunteers, while not wealthy, certainly had some degree of means, enough so that they could pay their own way down there and support themselves, not miss out on a summer job. A lot of African-American students coming out of the South and black colleges simply did not have that liberty, if you will. But I think if there is one thread that runs through it all, it is what Mark Levy had pointed out, and that is a sense of the times, a willingness to sacrifice, and also a real sense that this isn't I'm not going down to be a mission, to be a savior.
Mm-hmm.
This comes up repeatedly. And although, you know, you do have a little bit of that among some, it shows up in their letters. But, you know, for the most part, it was, you know, how can I be of service? And certainly if that wasn't the attitude before the orientation, SNCC and CORE drilled that in during the orientation, and you couldn't help but come away with, I'm a part of a team once you got on the ground in Mississippi.
So, Mark Levy, tell us what you did, what work you did when you arrived in Mississippi. What was your chore?
Originally, I had volunteered to work with the Voter Registration Project, and then Mickey Schwerner and Rita Schwerner convinced my wife, Betty, and me to switch to the Freedom Schools. And we were actually appointed to be the co-coordinators of the Meridian Freedom School. And to connect that to the previous question about what did I learn, one of the just amazing things that has stayed with me my whole career, both as a teacher and as an organizer, has been the way people thought about it, education there, and the connection between the Freedom Schools and the community and the instructions we had to ask questions and listen to the people and to respect the kids because they were survivors of a closed society and a terrorist society, and they knew more about their own lives than we did. So that level of respect that I learned to approach teaching really made a difference down there and has made a difference all my teaching life. So I worked in the Freedom Schools most of the time. I did some voter registration work also.
They needed Freedom Schools to teach the kids what, Hassan Jeffries?
A little bit of everything. So on the one hand, you know, part of the reason for the Freedom Schools, and Mississippi in 64 wasn't the first time that civil rights activists used Freedom Schools, was the poor quality of education that was offered to African-American youth. And so subject areas in Freedom Schools ran the gambit from French and math and English to world history, African-American history, and theater, drama. I mean, certainly Mark Levy can talk about some of the things that they did. But on the one hand, it was to sort of supplement, to fill an educational void for African-American youth. But on the other hand, it was also very much this empowering thing. So they were talking about things that simply were not allowed to be discussed in the public schools of Mississippi, talking about that dangerous thing of integration and desegregation, talking about what the movement could do, talking about voting rights and political empowerment. So it really was a school about freedom in its truest sense of the term.
So, Mark Levy, tell us about what you taught about some of those taboo subjects that you taught the kids.
Well, in addition to what was just mentioned, one of the main goals of the Freedom School was to build young leadership, because the understanding was that the struggle would be a long struggle. As young as the SNCC leaders were themselves in their teens and 20s, they needed to start talking with high school students who were going to be the next generation. So that was one of the goals of the Freedom School, in addition to the traditional curricular goals. The part of the Freedom School that I really liked the best was we asked a lot of questions, like, what does desegregation mean? What is the civil rights movement mean? If we're going to build a new world together, what exists in the world now that you want to keep? What would exist that you don't have? What exists now that we would want to get rid of? Any of those questions didn't have a yes or no or a testable answer. They were long discussions. And these were discussions between mainly white volunteers and the African-American students who had come and some of the older people had come. These were great open-ended discussions to peer into the future and try and figure out our values and our tactics and our vision for the future. That, as much as the other subjects that both were teaching subjects like French or empowerment and creative subjects, I think the political vision carried through for much of the summer.
Mark, were you frightened? Were you afraid of what the violence that was out there, the threats?
Well, anybody who wasn't frightened or afraid was not living in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, would have been a danger to all the people around them. So a healthy fear for the conditions was a requirement both to be accepted and to survive down there. But being afraid doesn't necessarily mean you turn around and leave. It doesn't mean that you stop doing what you were doing. Very shortly after I got there, in the first day or two, I realized that Ms. Dessie Turner, the woman whose house my wife and I were staying in, she was the brave one. She and her husband were risking their home, their family, their jobs, their lives, and they were going to stay. At some point, I was going back to New York. So it becomes easier to understand fear and to move past it when you see who you're working with and what their commitment is.
Mark Levy, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
to see a video about Mark Levy's time with the Freedom Summer Project and the photographs he took at that time, you can visit the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. This hour we're discussing the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project, which marks its 50th anniversary this year. In 1964, more than 700 student volunteers from across the country joined organizers in an effort to register and educate African-American voters. That story is told in a new PBS American Experience documentary called Freedom Summer. It airs next week on WOSU-TV. For more information, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. In this clip from the film, Freedom Summer organizer Rita Schwermer discusses the fears they had before they started.
There was very much a recognition and a debate about, is it responsible to bring all those kids into the state, most of whom are probably far too naive to understand what they were getting into in terms of the violent nature of the place.
Rita's husband, Michael, was one of the three activists who were murdered in the lead-up to that summer's activities. Still with us in the studio is OSU historian Professor Hassan Jeffries. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely.
And joining us now by phone from Iowa is a volunteer who worked in Mississippi in 1964 and who is featured in the documentary, Patty Miller. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Nice to be with you.
Does the description or the comment by Rita Schwermer about the debate about the responsibility of bringing people like you into Mississippi at that time, does that resonate with you? Were you aware of the danger, or what did you think?
Well, I had to chuckle when I heard her say naive, because that's exactly how I describe myself and a lot of us who went, especially those of us from the Midwest, who really had grown up not knowing any African Americans, nor, and many of us, you know, grew up in towns where there were none. So, yes, we were very naive. We learned very quickly what we were getting into, and I think, you know, we all thought that we were going to be able to help change things, and it was really us who were changed and moved and influenced by the welcome of the people in Mississippi, who were really the ones whose lives were in danger.
Yeah, Mark Levy did talk about that, that his host family, they were in much more danger than they were. And he mentioned that feeling of having, he knew he could get up and leave, they couldn't.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And in fact, there were people before Freedom Summer started who, just by trying to register to vote, were murdered. Just the simple act of, there was a state legislator in Mississippi who murdered Herbert Lee, who was trying to register to vote, and he was never tried for that, and everyone knew he had done it. So it was, I always talk about it as a third world country, especially in the 60s, just unbelievable things that the white power structure could get away with, and black people had no opportunity to find justice.
Hassan Jeffries, why was Mississippi so bad?
For a number of reasons. So on the one hand, it does stand out as being somewhat different. But then in many ways, it's very similar to other places in the South. One thing is important to understand, to realize about Mississippi, is that it was very rural. And because it was very rural, you had the persistence in many parts of the state of a slaveholder mentality. Too often when we think about sort of the civil rights era or the 60s, we tend to not think about the long legacy of slavery and the positions that it put people in, African-Americans being tied to the land. And only recently being moved off of the land because of mechanization, agricultural mechanization, a slow process in Mississippi. So, I mean, you have these sort of economic factors, you have these sort of demographic factors, a large black population, the fact that it's not an urban space, urban politics developed a little differently. Mm-hmm. But the commonality is that white supremacy reigned supreme. And that was a given. And it was deeply rooted. And so anyone, white or black, who contested white supremacy ran the risk of being killed because white supremacy was at the heart of both the political system as well as the economic system and the social order. Now, you know, it was at the heart of that which existed in Alabama and Georgia. But again, the differences have a lot to do not so much with 1964 and 1965, but the much longer legacy of attempts and mechanisms to control African-American labor over the course of a century after emancipation than it does 1965 or 64.
Patty Miller, while you were there, did you come across whites in Mississippi that were part of the solution or more often part of the problem?
I met not one that was a part of the solution. Hmm. That was, in fact, I did have an opportunity. Most of us never, volunteers who were there, we had no association with the white community. They would not have anything to do with us. If we even needed medical treatment or anything like that, we couldn't get it. We were a part of the black community and treated as such. But I did have the opportunity. There were a lot of ministers who came down that summer. They would come for just a week or two, and mostly to, you know, do what they could, but also to be of support to those of us who were much younger. And one day, I was in Meridian, where Mickey and Rita Schwerner had worked. And one day, which was very near Philadelphia, where the three civil rights workers were killed. Mm-hmm. So some ministers asked me to go with them into Philadelphia, and we stopped. It was on a Saturday, so we stopped at a number of white churches, and we knew that the ministers would be in their studies preparing their sermons, and so we went in, all of us white, and were very much welcomed as we walked in. And when we told them who we were, all of them, without exception, became very icy cold. They didn't kick us out. They were willing to have a slight conversation. What we were asking them to do was to speak up against the violence in their pulpits. And not one agreed to do that. Without exception, they all told us that things, we were troublemakers. We shouldn't be there, that we didn't understand their way of life. And that, you know, a lot of them quoted the Bible to us, and that this was the way things were meant to be between the races. So for me to be able to talk to a few white Southerners was the exception. I don't think there were a lot of young people who got to do that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Hassan Jeffries, there were some whites there, but Miss Mississippi at the time and her family were forced to move out of the state because of their support for the civil rights movement. But it was so few and far between.
Very few and far between. I mean, one of the things that it's important to keep in mind, I mean, you certainly have exceptions, is that, you know, white supremacy was able to hold sway in the state of Mississippi and throughout the South, not because it was the prerogative of a handful of politically powerful individuals. Mm-hmm. It was commonly held, deeply held belief and feeling among average Mississippians, average Alabamians. I mean, this was, as Ms. Miller just pointed out, I mean, this was, as they saw, their way of life, and they were trying to defend it. They believed deeply in it. And would do anything to maintain it. So you can certainly find a handful and there were, but they were few and far between. And you know, which is ironic when we sort of fast forward 50 years and you look at a movie like The Help and its, you know, sort of popularity. And, you know, it's telling a different story, a story that really didn't exist at the time.
Patty Miller, you were working while you were working in Mississippi. How aware were you, and you and the, your fellow volunteers, of the media attention and the perceptions from the rest of the country? How insulated were you, or how much were you aware of?
One of the values, I think, that the organizers realized when they invited us there was that there would be a lot of media attention back home up north. And so we were aware of that. I was called regularly by the Des Moines Register for stories, so that they would, and that was what the organizers of Freedom Summer had hoped would happen, is that more and more stories would start appearing in the north. I attended James Chaney's funeral in Meridian, and the church was just filled with reporters. So we were very much aware that we were being watched and that we were being covered. We didn't see the stories, but I think that was, for me anyway, personally, probably what gave me a little bit of sense of that I wasn't completely alone, because I was hearing from people in the north.
Was your life ever threatened, Patty?
Only slightly. As I was leaving, there had been another volunteer who had been beaten badly and had come and stayed with my host family, and he was supposed to show up at court before as we were leaving the state. And when we walked into the courthouse where he was to have had his hearing, the entire lobby of the courthouse was filled with a white mob. And it's still a blur today, but I just remember somehow someone managed to pull us out of the courthouse, and there was a car waiting outside, and we jumped in the car and drove away. I can't even imagine what would have happened had we stayed.
You know, Hassan Jeffries, when you think about it, that only three people were murdered in connection with that effort is sort of amazing.
It is, but it's not for want of trying. I mean, when you think about, you know, scores of churches and schools are burned.
That's right.
I mean, shootings are happening. Those host families and host communities, you know, were critical to protecting the volunteers coming down, not only welcoming and literally providing for them, but as Charlie Cobb just recently wrote a book, talks about their willingness to use guns to defend and to shoot back if necessary, and to make white folk, white terrorists aware that, you know, these freedom schools are going to be protected while kids are literally reading and studying under trees. In some places, there would be, the deacons, if you will, older men who would be in the car or around the corner. And so it is amazing. It is a miracle that that there wasn't more death, more tragedy. But that certainly we certainly shouldn't undercount the arsons, the burnings, the beatings that occurred almost daily over the course of that the 2 month high point of the project.
See, Patty Miller, when you talked about being in court over this beating of a fellow volunteer, was he in court as the accused or as the accuser?
Yeah. Oh, of course.
Okay, I just want to clarify that.
Yeah, it was always if you were beaten, they found a reason that you were the wrong person.
Okay.
That you were the person in the wrong. Just like when the three who were murdered, they were just driving from Philadelphia back to Meridian, and they were stopped for speeding, and they weren't speeding. They always found some reason to arrest us. We took a group of children. I worked at the community center, and we took a group of children on a picnic one day, and one of the other volunteers put a kitchen knife in his pocket so that we could cut the watermelon that we had. And someone told him, Tate, leave the knife in the office, because if you're walking down the street and they find anything on you, they're going to arrest you.
When you refer to it as a closed society, that's the way Professor Jeffries has described it. What was your impression of the children? This is like almost an alien type of being, someone from a completely different world.
That's right. That's right. They were wonderful. I mean, it was, for me, that was just a highlight of the summer, getting to know and be with these children. I mean, they would come up and they would rub my hair, you know, wanting to feel what a white person's hair looked like or felt like.
Uh-huh.
And these were the first time in their lives that white people had been kind to them. And I have gotten back in touch with one of the young men who was 9 when I worked there. And he's, of course, now in his 50s, and we correspond quite regularly. And he talks about that, how it was, for him, it was just such an amazing experience to have white people be kind to him and talk to him and play with him. There was one young man volunteer who would wrestle and play with the kids. And they were just, it was just delightful to have the experience, you know, both ways.
Patty Miller, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Patty Miller is a civil rights veteran and was working in Mississippi in 1964 during the Freedom Summer. There is a new American Experience documentary entitled Freedom Summer. It airs June 24th on WOSU-TV. For more information, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And while you're there, you can learn about the free advance screening of the documentary tonight. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Down to Mississippi, oh, I'm going down a southern road, and if you never see me again, remember that I had to go, remember that I had to go.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been remembering Freedom Summer, the civil rights project that brought hundreds of students to Mississippi in 1964 to register black voters and set up freedom schools. Members of the Ohio Student Association are planning a trip down to Mississippi to take part in activities to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the project. Still with us in the studio is OSU history professor Hassan Jeffries. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely.
And joining us now is James Hayes, Columbus political director of the Ohio Student Association. Welcome to the show, James.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is C. Joseph Sprague. He's a retired Methodist bishop and civil rights activist. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Before we move on to what's going to happen this summer at the commemoration, Hassan Jeffries, could you talk about whether or not, or if or what, or how would you describe the impact of that summer on the state of Mississippi?
I think there's a couple ways to sort of measure it. And I think perhaps the best way is to look at it in terms of the long-term impact. Certainly, there were, technically speaking, very few people who were registered. You don't really see a groundswell in actual people successfully registering to vote until after 1965. That does not mean that Freedom Summer did not have a lasting political impact. Of course, one of the major objectives of Freedom Summer was to build support for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, MFDP, and the challenge of the regular Democrats. They don't succeed in Atlantic City at the Democratic National Convention that fall, but they do succeed down the road in creating a much more democratic and open Democratic Party, Big D Democratic Party. And so politically, not immediately, but in the short term, moving towards the long term, we do see real change. And then also, I think one of the ways to sort of measure its impact is in the leadership that Mark Levy had talked about. One of the goals being develop a new generation, new cadre of leaders. And I think you can draw a direct line between many of the people who emerge as frontline political leaders, but then also community leaders in Mississippi in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, to participants in Freedom Summer, and most especially to the young people who were in the Freedom School. So taking a long-term view of the project, it certainly had a deep and lasting impact.
It sounds like the Freedom Schools had a greater impact than maybe even was expected, given that long-term.
I think so. I mean, going in, the hope would be that Freedom Schools could have this sort of transformative impact, not only on teachers, but certainly on students. I mean, that is, part of the objective. But certainly sort of looking back at it, and there's a reason why the Children's Defense Fund has used that model of Freedom Schools today, because it has that transformative impact on young people over time.
Bishop Sprague, you've taken part in the civil rights movement, including the Selma to Montgomery March in 1965, the next year, Freedom Summer in 1964 as well, right up through today. What changes have you seen doing this work over time? Any fundamental changes, or is it still, as Hassan Jeffries just referred to, it's being the patterns remain?
Some of the overt blockages have obviously been erased, the covert racism, the absence of the sharing of power, particularly economic power, still with us. You mentioned Freedom Summer and the Freedom Schools. I think it's interesting today, as a way to pick up on what's happening now, Marion Wright Edelman, who was one of those SNCC workers in 64, came back in 95 out of her organization and said it's time to revive Freedom Schools with an emphasis on the education of young at-risk children. Now, this summer, we'll have 20 Freedom Schools in Ohio, when a few years ago there were none. Some 13,000 youngsters have experienced the Freedom Schools. And last summer, those who participated showed a 68% increase in the capacity to read, some jumping as many as three grades with 6 weeks of training in the summer. Freedom School model worked, and it works.
What is the Freedom School model?
Today, it's a six-week program where youngsters learn to love to read. They're in an all-day program with two meals. They're mentored by people James's age who are college students, indigenous to the neighborhood. They're sent to the Haley Farm, trained for 2 weeks. They're paid $2,700 a year, which money goes back into their college tuition. And they help youngsters learn to love to read. The books reflect the faces and the stories of these kids. They take the books home each week, build a library, and then in the afternoon, they experience the community and community leaders, and are taught, as youngsters were in 64, that you can be a difference maker.
James, the description of the Ohio Student Association reads like it would have been involved in the Freedom Summer 50 years ago.
We certainly would have been involved in the Freedom Summer 50 years ago, but and that's why we're involved this summer. For the last several months, we've been working with young people of color around the nation to plan a summer program commemorating the legacy of the last 50 years by building for the future. The name of that collective is the Freedom Side, and it's anchored by organizations in Ohio, Florida with the Dream Defenders, and Texas with United We Dream, which is a national network of young undocumented Latino youth, and also young people in Mississippi who are carrying on the torch by fighting for a ballot initiative that will require their state to fully fund K-12 education.
What is planned for the trip to Mississippi? What is planned for the commemoration?
There's a couple different things happening. The SNCC Legacy Project is putting together a conference where there will be breakout sessions and opportunities for people to share lessons from the last 50 years of struggle, talk about strategies for moving forward. There will also be plenaries where, people will have workshops where people will be, engaging in conversations and learning a lot. But there's also a youth congress that's being organized by young people in Mississippi. We're really talking about building political power for young people, and even running young people for candidates, for offices. And as we leave Mississippi, this group of young people that's coming together is going to be going back out to our home states, our home communities, and continuing the work through the summer.
Is there, Bishop Sprague, an echo for you in groups like this? Have there been lapses of generations where you haven't seen this kind of activism before?
Yes, I, I, I look to the 80s with the Reagan administration and the capitulation to the understanding of private wealth, and then to the kind of political leadership in the 90s, rush to war, et cetera, within the church community where I live, where I'm active, a movement to individualism, to a kind of false spiritualism that divorces itself, I would say, as a Christian, from who Jesus was and what he taught. And so you put all of that together, and young people really didn't, for a long period of time, have the incarnated models, or not many incarnating models.
Meaning people, people walking in front of them who are showing them what to do.
Right, right. Whereas, for example, I went to Mississippi, to Selma, et cetera, because of the dean of my seminary, who had been arrested. He was a Southerner, had been arrested, seeking to integrate a United Methodist church in Jackson, along with three professors. And when we were asked by the black community to come and help keep public facilities open, it was the natural thing to do. I couldn't imagine church being anything else but that. And so across my lifetime, from one set of issues that are all part of the same patchwork quilt. For me, it has been a continuing movement, but there have been big, big breakages in the church community, in the political community, surely in the economic community. And I can understand why young people until very recently pretty much were on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm. So, Hassan Jeffries, what do you think has turned that around?
Well, I think it's important to look at numbers. Even sometimes we think back to sort of the heyday of the civil rights movement, and we think many more people were involved than they were. Right?
Like a lot of people on television.
It certainly does, right. But it certainly was not.
That's
right?
Okay. I like to say if everybody had been in Selma who says they've been there, the North American continent would have tipped into water.
Absolutely. So you know, sort of keeping that in mind. There never have been sort of a great many people. I mean, sort of even sort of local movements, if you got 10% of the people mm-hmm. involved on sort of a daily basis, that was enough to really make a difference. So I think what sort of and James certainly can speak to this. And I would love to hear what he has to say, that you don't need many people. But there are moments when you do see more people getting involved, involved at levels of sort of high intensity, high impact. And James certainly is representative of that mm-hmm. now. And so I would love to hear if...
Yeah, James, tell us about what triggered it for you and for a lot of your contemporaries, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, I think for young people, especially this particular generation, I think you can trace a lot of it back to the political moment surrounding Trayvon Martin's murder and the acquittal of George Zimmerman. I know for us in Ohio, that moment of the acquittal last summer sparked this energy. And out of that, we took a group of 20 to D.C. for the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington last August. And that's actually where we met up with many of the young people who are part of this mm-hmm. collective today. I think it's... if you look at the generation that was executing the sit-ins in the 60s, many of them were Emmett Till's age when Emmett Till was murdered. And I think you can see a correlation where there are these political moments mm-hmm. that cause people to really question the foundations of the society. And those are moments of heightened awareness and heightened activity. Right. And the role that organizations like ours play is how to capture some of that and push it forward. Understanding that those moments come and go, but the organizing needs to sustain and persist.
So it's your own moment, but it's not a moment of happiness. It's a moment of, once again, tragedy moves people.
Well, certainly it's a moment of sort of ongoing struggle. And I can mm-hmm. say this because I had the good fortune of having James as a student and a brilliant student at that. James had studied the civil rights movement. He was part of the Children's Defense Fund, taught in the Freedom Schools. And so If there was, and as a historian, we talk about the Emmett Till generation. Mm-hmm. In 1960, those students who joined SNCC and are part of the sit-ins were Emmett Till would have been their age in 1960. And I wondered very much, and I wasn't the only one, would there be a Trayvon Martin generation where people saw in young people of color saw in themselves, so saw what happened to Trayvon Martin, a mirror reflection of themselves. And certainly from what James is saying, that many did. But they're linking up with people like James, who had already been politically active, who had already been thinking about these issues, who had already been learning from veteran organizers. And so I think what we're seeing now are those two groups of people, people who are just getting engaged and people who have been engaged and looking for ways to sort of heighten their activism and get others involved. We're seeing them come together now. And I think that's represented by James here, but then also by the fact that he's helping to bring folk and a part of groups going down and connecting yes. with people across the yes. across the nation.
Well, James Hayes, when people in your organization, you're the Columbus political director of the Ohio Student Association. Has the Ohio Student Association been around for a long time, and it's just sort of being reinvigorated? Where did that come from? And tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was a senior at OSU, January 2012, I was part of a group of about 150 students from around the state that came together sort of out of two different currents. One was the youth wing of the fight to repeal Senate Bill 5 in the We Are Ohio fight. There was an effort on the college campuses led by an organizer, Will Klatt. And he was, you know, going around talking with students all over the state.
And Senate Bill 5, just to remind people, was the legislation that would have struck down collective bargaining rights for public employees. But go ahead.
Yeah. And then it failed.
It actually succeeded, but then the voters took it down with issue 2 the following November.
So. Yeah. And so, you know, following that victory and also that fall, Occupy Wall Street happened, and that unleashed a lot of energy among young people, especially on the college campuses across the country. And in Ohio, it was the same thing. And so sort of out of those two currents, people came together to talk about how do we create an institution that can represent young people and build grassroots political power for our generation over a long period of time. And we created the Ohio Student Association. And I was fortunate enough to come on staff that August later after I graduated from OSU. We've been building ever since, working with young people, not just on college campuses, but also in the neighborhoods, in our cities. And we work on issues of educational justice or injustice, you know, so we focus sort of on college access and student debt at the higher ed level, and also what we call the school-to-prison pipeline at the K-12 level. We also work on, you know, voting rights and other issues that affect young people. But that's really how we got our start. We're working with young people in Cleveland, Akron, Kent, Columbus, Dayton, Cincinnati. There's also, we have young people at, you know, University of Toledo and Ohio University. You know, this summer is a chance for us to continue the, you know, to build off the legacy people like Bishop Sprague, you know, lived and build for the future. You know, our website, www.ohiostudentassociation.org. We have a calendar up there, so there's, you know, events that are happening each week all through the summer. And so I encourage listeners, if they would like to get involved, to check out the website.
We'll post that website on our website at wosu.org/allsides if it's not there already. James Hayes, thanks for joining us today. Have a good trip down to Mississippi.
Oh, thank you. And I'd be happy to share some reflections when we get back, share some of the lessons.
That would be great. Thank you. James Hayes, he's the Columbus political director of the Ohio Student Association. Also, C. Joseph Sprague, he's a retired Methodist bishop and civil rights activist. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And as always, Hassan Jeffries, Ohio State University historian, thanks to you for sharing the hour with me.
Thank you.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.